So in my quest to bring you really great guests, and you all know that my idea of a great guest is one that makes us take a good analytical look at our own behavior, I came across a book called Promiscuous Eating. First, I did judge a book by its cover because I loved the name so much and said, yes, we need Dr. Siegel on the show. So Dr. Siegel received his medical degree from the Chicago Medical School and completed a residency in general surgery at the North Shore University Hospital, an affiliate of Cornell University School of Medicine, and pursued residency training in urology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Thereafter, he did a fellowship in female pelvic reconstructive surgery at the UCLA School of Medicine prior to joining Bergen Urological Associates in Hackensack, New Jersey, where he's been in practice since 1988. Dr. Siegel is an avid believer in remaining young, healthy, and fit through the practice of exercise, nutritional conscientiousness, love that expression, and intelligent lifestyle choices. He is the author of Finding Your Own Fountain of Youth, The Essential Guide to Maximizing Health, Wellness, Fitness, and Longevity, published in 2008. His second book, which we're talking about today, Promiscuous Eating, Understanding and Ending Our Self-Destructive Relationship with Food, was published in 2011. And his latest book, Male Pelvic Fitness, Optimizing Sexual and Urinary Health, will be published in the summer of 2013. So that's coming up. Please welcome Dr. Andrew Siegel here to bestinhealthradio.com. Good morning, Dr. Siegel.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Shira.
It's a pleasure to have you. But I have to say, when I saw the book, I'm thinking, a urologist?
It is pretty strange. This really was a venture that is well outside my domain.
Don't think it's outside your domain at all, because what I like about speaking to different specialists all about health and fitness is you all have a very different perspective. And I think that's very cool. And I think perspective is something that's really, really important. So yeah, it's a urologist. That sounds good. And it's a seriously great book.
Well, thank you very much.
So you know what I think the Fountain of Youth is?
What is a Fountain of Youth?
To me, I
know your answer. 90 minutes of exercise a day.
Well, pretty close. I say the Fountain of Youth is our own sweat, and the stinkier, the better.
I think you're right. I think that's a big part of it.
No question.
I think the Fountain of Youth is pretty obvious, what it actually comes down to. You know, eating right, exercising, being unstressed, having passions, having purpose.
I like that. That's very good. Absolutely. Passion and purpose. Very, very true. Because I think that's our motivator. That's what gives us the kick that every single one of us needs.
I'll tell you, I take care of a lot of older patients, people in their 80s and 90s, and those who are doing well, those who are thriving, those who are really living maximally, are still working. Interestingly enough, maybe not full-time, maybe not getting paid for it, but they wake up in the morning, you know, with direction and purpose and passion, and that makes an extraordinary difference, I think, in one's lifestyle and longevity.
I'm very spoiled because I have my parents. My dad is, he'll kill me if I get this wrong, he's 86 or 87, plays tennis for a couple of hours every day, goes to the gym every day, does every sport, bikes, you name it, does everything. And he is truly, he's remarkable. I mean, his mind, he still works, he does everything, he's still a successful business person. And there is no such thing as sitting down. My mom, well, I work her really hard at the gym. There's no question. But you know what? It's true. I look at the way they've aged compared to, forgive me, a lot of their friends that go off to Florida. Wow, am I going to get emails about this? That go off to Florida and, forgive me, sit and vegetate.
It's so true. I can't recall what movie it was that I saw where there was a line, retirement is death with benefits, something like that. I think that's what it comes down to. I'm fortunate, too. I mean, I lost my mother a while ago, but my father's going to be 82. He's in Florida, live, well, golf, tennis, active as can be.
That's the way to do it.
So
that's
another big point in your favor. If you can pick your ancestors well, that's going to help your longevity big time.
But can you clarify that? That's not luck of the genetic gene pool. That's,
yes, I'm saying that genetics is obviously very important. I mean, if you have two parents who live into their late 90s, that's going to be a big point in your favor that, you know, you probably do not have serious cardiovascular disease. You know, lifestyle is huge, but genetics is very important as well. What is the saying? Genes load the gun and lifestyle pulls the trigger.
One of my favorite expressions. Excellent. I've never heard that. That's very good. That's excellent. Okay, so tell us, please, Doc, what is, besides a great name, what is promiscuous eating?
Promiscuous eating is eating for purposes other than genuine hunger, particularly when it's done casually and unselectively and without regard to consequence. It's basically an unhealthy relationship with the food and a lack of a long-term commitment to eating properly for the right reasons in the right manner at the right speed. It's making poor food choices that in the long term are hazardous to our health. It's really consuming food for purposes other than satisfying our genuine hunger. And as a byproduct of it, we don't feel well about ourselves. We wake up the next morning after a bout of promiscuous eating feeling bloated and uncomfortable and angry at ourselves.
That's right.
Feeling guilt and regret and remorse.
Yeah.
And the way that I came up with that term is I was listening to my wife's friend tell me about her bout of emotional eating, which was late night eating, and it was in a large quantity of poor quality junk food, and she just felt disgusted with herself, and she woke up in the morning bloated and guilty and regretful, and then I said, boy, that sounds like promiscuous behavior, and therein the term came to be.
Excellent. Now, you and I, we share this really down to our core belief. Okay, and I think it transcends everything we do personally and professionally. We know that being, as you call it, nutritionally conscientious, exercising, living a good, clean, healthy lifestyle, we know that it is not sacrifice and self-torture like many people do think, but we know it's really what liberates us, what makes us happy. I mean, I personally talk about creating our own personal ecosystem, that inner peace, and it all comes from having that, I always call it our joie de vivre, our zest for life. And, you know, I think what we need to do here is for people to understand what we're talking about. No, it's not sacrifice. It's not self-torture. We need to understand the reasons that we're eating. We need to take a good hard look at analyzing our own behavior. So can you please go through and talk about the different types of eating that you talk about? Yeah, there's hunger, loss in the list, recreational, opportunistic, temptation, et cetera, et cetera. Can you go through those for us, please?
Sure. I would be happy to. Okay, so hunger eating is pretty obvious. That's the real thing, the genuine thing. Our body craves nutrition and calories to fuel our processes and provide the fodder for cellular and tissue replenishment and repair. And that's the reason we should be eating. Recreational eating I define as sport eating, hobby eating, entertainment eating, bon appetit. We all love it. You know, occasionally going out to a nice restaurant and Not just going for the purpose of nutrition and calories, but for the purpose of pure enjoyment and recreation and as a fun thing to do. Opportunistic eating is when there is unexpected availability and exposure to food, and this is very dangerous for many people. We're at work, and somebody brings in donuts. And all of a sudden, we are confronted with an opportunity that is potentially dangerous, and this requires a lot of willful restraint. Kind of overlaps a little bit with temptation eating, because opportunistic eating is temptation eating. But in addition, temptation eating is defined as we're not really hungry, but we are prompted to eat by perhaps the scent, the sight of food, where it's a bakery and we smell a delicious smell. We're watching television, we see a commercial for food, and it just triggers our desire to eat. I define accessory eating as the expected consumption that is an accessory to other activities. For example, we go to the movies.
Right,
we are
gotcha.
Expected to eat popcorn and candy. We see other people doing it. It's socially acceptable. It is the norm.
Right.
I define social eating as food is so important as a role of, for lack of a better term, glue to all our social activities, getting together with friends,
yeah.
businesses, weddings, etc.
Yeah.
Reward eating is eating that is compensation for either an accomplishment or perceived hardships. Graduate college, we go out for a great meal. We're having a difficult situation. We go get a chocolate ice cream sundae, that kind of thing. Fatigue eating, which is...
That's a big one.
That's a big one for me.
Yeah, me too.
get up early, stay up late, exercise hard, work hard. It's 9 o'clock at night. I'm exhausted. I should go to sleep. But I think what happens is being fatigued and being tired confounds our mindfulness and our discipline.
Yeah.
And on a biochemical basis, there are real underpinnings to this: increased cortisol and other hormones that drive eating. Under those circumstances. Boredom eating, that's a big one also.
Yes, it is.
I define that as eating as a pastime, as something to do to fill a void that is otherwise lacking.
Ah, very true.
Drug-induced eating, for example, alcohol, that's a good one for me too. If I have a glass or two of wine, it definitely subverts my mindfulness and discipline.
No question. And also alcohol causes us to store body fat, but we won't go there. Yeah.
Yeah, that too. And, you know, plus it's liquid carbs, you know, rapidly absorb. Ritual eating, bar mitzvahs, weddings, Thanksgiving, Easter, you know, et cetera. We eat under every circumstance. Eating is such a fundamental component to our existence. And then there's emotional eating, which I guess we'll be getting into in detail.
Right.
But let's just review the other reasons. Seasonal eating, definitely a role for me also. I call it winter hibernation mode. There's just something, and you in Canada probably know this better than
oh, yes.
us in the States. I remember going, I used to have a girlfriend in Winnipeg.
Oh, boy.
I went to
That's
visit
cool.
her in September, and I didn't realize it was winter in September in Winnipeg. I mean, there was frost
that
there.
Right.
I mean, I brought short sleeve clothes, mm-hmm. shirts and shorts. So in any case, winter, cold, dark. There's less healthy eating, less healthy cooking, less
and
availability
our body tells
to
us
exercise.
For food.
There's less need for fitting into bathing suits. There's so many circumstances.
Yep.
And then there's habit eating, habitual eating, learned ingrained behaviors.
Ah.
We turn on the television, we need a snack, we walk to our kitchen when we get home, go to the refrigerator or pantry.
Yes.
And then there are a million and one emotional reasons
to eat. Which is why I don't like the term. I told you this, Doc. I don't like the term emotional eating because I find it's become a cliche for talk shows. Forgive me. And I think it's something that when people say, oh, it's emotional eating, it just becomes another universal scapegoat as opposed to dealing with, okay, let's break it down. Let's see what the motives are. Let's see what the triggers are. Let's figure it out. It's just become, oh, well, I'm stressed, so I'm emotionally eating. So, yeah, I have an issue with that one. So that's one that people, I think, need to break down more than anything.
I agree. I think we need to be very specific and just search for the, you know, the specific emotion that is driving the issue.
Exactly. And when you were talking about opportunistic eating before, you got me thinking, I work with a number of ICU nurses. And what really, really surprises me, I kind of figure it this way. You're working in ICU, you're working with some sick people.
Absolutely.
Okay. And I would say the vast majority of the ones that I've known and I've worked with very, very heavy. And I used to think, well, you know what? Their circadian rhythms are all messed up, which just wreaks havoc with the metabolism because of shift work. Okay, shift work, there is no question, takes a toll on the metabolism. And then I realized their ICU is always filled with donuts and cookies and garbage. And they said, well, you know, families of patients bring it in for us, and that's what we eat. So I went ahead for a major hospital in downtown Toronto, and I made a sign, and it said, please do not feed the bears, okay? Everybody laughed hysterically, okay?
Fabulous.
If you love us, please bring us in fruit platters, vegetable platters. I gave a long list of places in the area where things can be picked up. But please do not bring us cookies and donuts, whatever. Because people think they're being kind. They're being, you know, it's a source of appreciation to people taking care of your loved ones. And no, it's not. It's not appreciation at all.
I agree with you. You may as well bring tobacco.
I agree. Totally. Yeah, exactly.
And you know what the crazy thing is? I have a real thing about this. There are many hospitals, and things are changing now. Not only were they're just replete with junk food, but they actually have McDonald's in their lobbies. I was at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where they actually had a McDonald's.
That is so now, deplorable.
Now, Ronald McDonald House. They've done wonderful
fabulous
things.
Fabulous work, yes.
Fabulous work, but just somehow that is the wrong message, and that is changing rapidly. But you're absolutely right. There's opportunistic eating in hospitals and for healthcare workers. In my medical office, there's always a patient bringing in Dunkin' Donuts or pizza, or there's constant exposure, and it's difficult for a lot of people when opportunity is placed right in front of you. It's very difficult to have the discipline to walk away.
It is,
or to be moderate.
And they're tired and they're fatigued. They work really hard.
So you are absolutely right.
It's what we call the perfect storm.
Right. There are many emotions.
Oh yeah,
at that time. And ongoing simultaneously, and there's opportunity.
Yeah.
And when you put all that together, you're right. Perfect storm.
Wow. Okay. So Women's Health Magazine did this poll recently. Don't know if you caught it, where it said 30% of their readers are stressed constantly every day about food. And I just kind of want to know your thoughts on, I think it's a love-hate relationship we have with food, guilt, such an unconstructive emotion. What do you say about that?
I agree with you. It is pure love-hate. We all love food. I do.
Of course
we
do.
It's a great, I mean, there are people who don't love food. I am married to somebody who is indifferent about food, which to me is the most amazing thing.
It is.
Because I love it. We love food. It's a great source of sensual pleasure for most of us. Much of our culture revolves around food.
Yes.
We need it to survive. It's, as I said before, it functions as social glue and lubricant. Dates, family meals, business luncheons, etc. But additionally, it's medicine for many of us. It soothes us. We have stressed and beaten souls. It offers us short-term emotional rewards way beyond the caloric and nutritional value. So that's the love, but we hate it because it's basically pleasure and rewards aspect make it prone to abuse. And it's easy to abuse, and its excess consumption makes us fat. And for many of us, I think stress is huge in general in driving short-term relief of the emotional need, but without a long-term solution. And yes, the addition of then a secondary guilt because of the unnecessary indulgence.
I believe, and obviously you do too, that our relationship with food is just as critical as what we eat in terms of being problematic to our health. And I'm not going to say just in terms of weight. I don't like to limit this just to weight because you know as well as I do that some people can eat and eat and eat and stay skinny and they think, okay, they've got to get out of jail for free card. They're just fine. So it's not just about weight. It's about how they feel inside. It's about what they're doing to their body. But I don't think enough people focus on their relationship with food and the reasons they eat. We've gotten far too obsessed, especially with half the garbage on the internet, about what to eat and what not to eat. What do you say about that?
You know, I agree with you. I think, you know, what we eat is certainly important. If you want to use an automobile analogy, you want to put high octane quality fuel into our tanks so our engines run optimally. And if to continue on the car metaphor, I think that many people are more attuned to caring for their cars than their bodies.
No question.
So we are what we eat, and the food that we consume is ultimately going to become us. So clearly our health destiny and the quality and quantity of what we eat will affect the quality and quantity of our lives. So that it is clearly important what we eat, but on the other hand, you are totally right. Our relationship with food is nothing short of profound in terms of our health. And I think that a healthy relationship with food, which is not easy necessarily to establish for a variety of reasons, is when food serves its purpose for fuel and nutrition, and we are able to achieve a balance between, you know, pleasure and discipline restraint. And I think much of the time, food ends up serving, when we're very introspective about it, as a major means of comfort, an emotional pacifier, just like alcohol, just like tobacco, or just like other drugs can. And then its use becomes maladaptive. So I think that when eating is driven by an appetite for positive feelings that are derived from the consumption of food, not for an appetite for food itself, we often end up eating way too much, way too many calories, particularly at those moments, bad calories.
Right.
So it's very important, I think, to be introspective and understand that sometimes our thoughts and our emotions are the root cause of this, you know, poor or discordant alliance with food.
Now, I liked what you were saying about being introspective, and I think that's something that people just don't do enough of. We're often in what I call robo mode. We go around running our lives, running around, doing things in a rote kind of way, not necessarily paying attention to what we're doing. We know people drive that way. I mean, this is a serious thing that people have to take a look at. And we all have different ways that we encourage people to understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. What do you suggest for people to maybe get a little bit better on doing their own critique of their eating behaviors?
First of all, I just want to agree with you. I think most of us are not introspective about our eating habits,
so
relationship
true.
With food, or probably anything.
Yeah.
We have behavior and habits that have been created over the long term, and I think the very nature of a habit is that it's reflex and rote, and it's associated with little thought. And I personally never realized why I succumbed to, for lack of better terms, maladaptive eating behaviors until I sat down and really thought about it. And the factors for me were stress, fatigue, and alcohol. And basically, so much of what we do in life is relatively mindless.
That's
so I'd say in the quest towards health in general, being introspective about one's relationship with food is a monumental step in the process of change and progress. If you want to improve, you have to be aware. And that's forget about food and eating. That's anything in life. Awareness is a fundamental prerequisite to self-improvement. Self-awareness is a vital component. And as you said, I think many people are walking around mindlessly. We have a tendency to be checked out. If you can possibly tap into what you're doing and why you're doing it by being aware and connecting and being present, that's the start to improving the relationship. So on a practical basis, I guess what I'm trying to say is that in terms of one's relationship with food, before putting a food substance into your mouth, we need to be mindful of the following question. Is this something that we want to place into our physical selves Do we want this to actually become us, to be integrated into our beings? What exactly is it that we're eating? What's its origin? What's its source? Why are we consuming it? Where are we eating it? When are we eating it? How are we eating it? How much are we eating? I mean, those are a lot of questions, but can provide some real meaningful answers.
You got me thinking there. We know our world has become very much about instant gratification. You know, instant messaging, instant this, instant that, instant everything, instant food, instant relationships, instant, you name it. And if it's not instant, it's disposable. And I'm thinking, if we really, you know, along with the what's in it for me attitude and instant and combining those two, and yes, all of these fast food choices being flashed in our faces all the time, I think what happens is, yes, that is definitely encouraging people to not be mindful. But also, instead of thinking what's in it for me in terms of a health perspective, in terms of, you know, in terms of feeling good, in terms of looking good, in terms of, you know, having a, you know, being what I call having your ecosystem in its happy place. You know, I mean, I think it's become more about, I hate to use the word, it's a little bit strong, hedonistic, instant gratification.
I think you're right. When it comes to eating, we think short term, not long term. You know, many of us. Instant gratification, opportunistic eating, something is sitting there, put it in our mouths. We don't necessarily consider long term consequences.
Because we justify everything that we're busy.
And part of the problem is the way we are designed. I mean, if you think about it, I've always been fascinated by hunger and nutrition. I mean, we were designed to enjoy food, so that would encourage eating and nutrition and preservation of the individual. There's a link between enjoyment and nutrition.
Sure.
It's the ultimate bait and switch of nature. I mean, we think we're just getting this short-term, enjoyable, sensual experience, but we're actually getting long-term preservation, you know, for biological purposes. And that's why it's so easy to abuse.
And we have an override for that switch right now, okay? I mean, there's no question. I agree. It should be, you go back to my favorite scientist of all time, Darwin. Survival of the fittest, and that's why we survived. That's why we had the evolutional advantage. But on the other hand, I think that's become now everyone justifies things. I'm busy, leave me alone. You see people in their cars munching on a bag of potato chips or a candy bar. The truth is, why isn't that a bag of cut up vegetables? Why? Because the cut up vegetables took some forethought. Although just about any grocery store now you can pick up those cut up vegetables, but that's besides the point. I mean, that's what it's become about. Everyone thinks they're busier than everybody else, so therefore I don't have time. And what I deal with clients as a health coach is you do have time. Exercise does not have to be in a gym. You know, there is time, and you find people time and you show them that really no time has become a cliche.
You are right. I think it is so important to carve out time for yourself. And so many of us don't do that.
Not to mention role model for our kids.
Absolutely.
No question. No question. I have three grown men, and I see the way they make their food choices now, which men their age, it could be very, very different. And absolutely. I look at what they like. What they like as a dessert is a fruit crisp, because that's what they grew up having. You know, I mean, it really, and I think the most important thing is role modeling for your kids, and that is showing love for your kids. Okay, so a loaded question for you I've been dying to ask you. Remember, you're a man talking to a bunch of women. Yes, men too, but there are a bunch of women. Your thoughts on cravings and time of the month cravings?
Okay, I interviewed a lot of people regarding their eating habits, and I clearly learned from the female population that cravings are very real. And I think they're probably biological in origin. And in the book, I use the term hormonal eating. Basically, many of the women I interviewed related that in the week or so before menstruation, they experienced an increased appetite and cravings for certain foods, and they seem to be soft in general. And interestingly enough, this is similar to how pregnancy affects appetite and hunger. So the consensus was that it is not uncommon to develop a ravenous appetite with cravings for salt and carbohydrates. So very real, very biological.
Okay. However, the danger spot there, I'm just thinking way word this, the danger spot there, and I totally agree with you because I just see it too often, is I believe big time, we're going to talk about in a bit about food addictions. It's been proven over and over that certain foods definitely have high sugar, high salt, high saturated fat, addictive qualities. And when someone has been, excuse me if you think this is a loose term of the word, binging on certain foods, binging meaning relative to normal consumption, it's sometimes for a lot of people, it's very hard to go back to saying, okay, I got my period, done, over, move on.
I think you're right. I learned from interviewing people that there is a subset of the population that is addicted to carbohydrates.
No question.
And that they cannot indulge. Going off the wagon.
Yep.
Is going to be
like alcohol,
vicious,
like smoking.
Exactly. They can't have just one. They can't just indulge. In fact, the very person who I interviewed who ended up giving me the idea for the term promiscuous eating is a carb addict, and cannot eat carbs. One bagel will do her in, and that behavior will lead to a downward spiral of decompensation. Now, I don't think it's a huge percentage of the population that is addicted to that extent.
But I think your body definitely, when you've had empty sugar, empty carbs, I think if you talk about, which is going to unfortunately take us off track, but really helps here, ghrelin, leptin, you kind of understand why it makes you crave more.
Absolutely.
And there's real physiological reasons for it. But what I try and suggest to people, yeah, it works for some people, it doesn't work for others, is finding substitutes. Changing the way you eat at a healthy snack time, at a healthy meal time, to help you prevent those cravings. And there are ways that we can do it. You know, but again, it takes what you talk about, being mindful.
Which is difficult.
Okay.
Which requires work and energy.
No question. So another one of my favorite scientists, you bring him up in your book, Freud. Okay, still my favorite psychologist. The id, the ego, and the superego. Come on, so much fun to study. And
absolutely.
A whole lot of truth. A whole lot of truth. I think it's the kind of truth people don't like to admit to. But I think a lot of this eating, besides the physiological addictions, which, as I mentioned, we are going to get into, is what I call our instinctual id. And I was thinking about that a lot when you were talking about mindful and mindless eating. And then, yes, I saw later on you got into Freud. Can you please discuss that with us?
Sure. Yeah, Freud's terrific. And I think the framework of the psyche that he devised can be helpful as a lens for analyzing eating behaviors. I mean, so without going into too much psychobabble, you know.
Oh,
we
it's
have
not
the,
psychobabble.
Okay. All right, good. We have the ego, the id, and the superego. And basically, I like to think of the ego as the adult, responsible for the balance between the primitive drives and reality, mediating between the poles of the id and the superego. And then there's the id, which operates in accordance with the pleasure principle, which can be thought of as the child within or alternatively the devil inside. And I think id-driven eating could also be called promiscuous eating. And then there's the other pole, the superego, which is basically our conscience. And the superego aims for perfection and punishes misbehavior with guilt. And the superego can be thought of as the angel within. So in terms of our eating can be id-driven, in which we, as you stated before, we're thinking just short-term, immediate pleasure and gratification with absolutely zero thought to the long-term consequences, a devil-may-care attitude, so to speak. By the same token, there are some people, and this is rare but real, superego-driven eating, who scrutinize, deliberate carefully about any food item that is consumed. The ultimate in mindfulness, which is probably not healthy either.
And I think some people classify that as an eating disorder.
They do. I believe they call it orthorexia now. I mean, just too much of a disciplined behavior.
Being obsessed over it, yeah.
Exactly. And then there's, I think for the most of us, there's ego-driven eating, which is the compromise between the two polar extremes. It's human behavior practiced by at least the one-third of the population that maintains a healthy weight. I mean, generally, sensible eating with occasional excursions into id domain and then superego domain that allows us to right ourselves after we've overindulged. So some of us display primarily ego-driven eating. Some are id-driven. Some are superego.
And what would you call those of us who kind of, yeah, we accept that there's going to be times where we're going to be not so great, but we're, you know, people are pretty faithful about it, eating a good, clean, healthy diet, but not obsessing. Would you call that ego?
Yes, that's adult behavior.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes I like to quantitate that as the 80-20 diet, like 80% of the time, very disciplined and very careful and, you know, letting yourself go every once in a while, enjoying a good meal on the weekend, having an ice cream sundae. I mean, we're humans after all, and life's short.
I'm actually, you just triggered something inside me, and I'm going to interrupt myself here in my thought process. I kind of get upset with people, and I have to deal with this clients a lot when people, and I get it too, and I'm sure you get it. Oh, let yourself go. Let yourself enjoy. Let yourself go. Now, here's where I have an issue with that. Who's to say my pleasure has to be derived from food? When I can say to myself, no, I don't want that piece of cake. I don't enjoy it. I'll get a headache. I'll feel disgusting, especially tomorrow. And it's just not worth those couple of seconds of enjoyment. The fallout, as I call it, okay?
It's right, that's a good term,
it's
the fallout.
Eat it today, wear it tomorrow, okay? It's just, and this is where I get after people. It's, and I know you and I could easily do a whole show on this. It's defining what your pleasure is. Our pleasure does not have to be from food. There are so many beautiful things in life to derive pleasure from. I personally derive pleasure from being told I look so much younger than I am. I derive pleasure from feeling really great inside and not having a sugar headache. And I derive pleasure in the fact that hopefully I will live to an old age to drive my sons crazy. Okay.
I agree. And you derive pleasure probably in looking good.
Yes.
Looking good and feeling
good.
Yes,
I do. Yes, I do. And I think that's part of the problem that plays on people, or they go to a friend's house. No, I'm sorry, you came to my house. I made this dessert. You have to try this dessert. Now, I admit, and God, I hope some of these people aren't listening, I've been known to say, you know what? I'm really not hungry now. The food was really good. I'm going to be quiet. I can hear you laughing. I'm going to take it home and have it after my workout in the morning. Yeah, I don't have it after my workout in the morning. It's just not worth arguing someone over what my definition of pleasure is. And a lot of people are guilt-ridden by this. Well, no, they said, and I had to. I'm like, really? We have to define what our and people have to respect. You know, I had a bunch of girlfriends recently. They made me a beautiful birthday party. Okay. And hey, everyone knew it was my birthday party. It was great food. It was salmon. It was vegetables. Yeah. It was great food. Okay. I mean, because, you know, it was my girlfriend's thinking of me and what I call pleasure and what I would enjoy. But I think that's a serious problem there, is that whole concept. See, I told you, you got me off on that. Is that whole concept of that instinctual id and finding sources of pleasure other than food.
You are right. You know, and it can be very difficult because of peer pressure and id-driven behavior coupled with opportunity. I mean, that spells trouble. But at the same time, I have to say that I don't believe in complete deprivation. I don't think that's necessarily
Absolutely.
Healthy, because it'll come back to haunt you.
Yes.
And that's why I like to use the term. I use this term in the book called vaccinate and inoculate, which means, you know, if you're confronted with a colleague's birthday party and they have an ice cream cake, just take a If you want a little piece, take a tiny little piece. I mean, all you really want in life is a taste. You're not eating it to satisfy hunger.
Right.
You don't want to feel full from that, but a little stimulation. That's not going to hurt anything.
Great.
Unless, once again, you're the segment of the population that has addictive food tendencies.
Okay, so Dr. Siegel, we've mentioned it a couple of times, but I think it's really important that we talk about it, is we know factually, had the Yale Red Center for Food and Addictions on the show many times before, certain foods are physiologically addictive, just like cigarette smoke, just like cocaine. Salt, sugar, fat. Never mind the alcohol, that's another story. But just talking about salt, sugar, fat. Now, compounding that with the psychological perspectives of eating that we've been discussing, okay. And, of course, there's the wonderful factor of those junk food companies and the marketers, and forgive me, we're all prey. How do we help people here?
That is a big problem. I mean, no question about it. Junk food, aggressive marketing, these companies who have brilliant food scientists on their payroll who literally,
yeah.
You know, brilliant people with pharmaceutical backgrounds who have figured out the precise ingredients to create the most addictive concoction. There was, I don't know if you saw this, this was New York Times Magazine section maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, a beautiful article on the science behind the food industry and how clever they are in creating addictive foods.
Just like the tobacco industry.
Exactly, identical. So we've got a big problem. Once again, another perfect storm situation. We have the stressful lives that most of us live. We have a sedentary existence that many of us have. And then we have what I call the industrial food complex, which has created this limitless array of unhealthy processed foods that are they're readily available. They're aggressively marketed and promoted, they're inexpensive, and they're addictive or potentially addictive. And, you know, the bottom line is we need an alternative means of stress management aside from finding solace in sugar, fat, and salt. We need to get off our duffs and exercise, and we need to think about junk foods, like you say, in the same terms as tobacco. And I so agree with you, and I made parallels between the tobacco industry and the industrial food complex. And hopefully there will come a day when, like the tobacco industry, the industrial food complex will be regulated, will
no,
be censored.
No, it's shut down every time we try. There's been many attempts in New York City and San Francisco. We've had many attempts, and somehow they never succeed. Everyone says, we have the freedom to choose what we want to eat.
You know, I think it's probably worse than the tobacco. Because
exactly.
there are more consumers. I mean, deceptive marketing practices, focus on prosperity, disregard to the human tragedy and social costs.
And food is a necessity of life.
Absolutely. I mean, we are so in need of legislation, and
yes,
I think that's
are.
Where it's got to start, that is capable of preventing children from starting down the misdirected path that leads to obesity, diabetes, et cetera. We need transparency. I mean, it's gotten a little bit better, but still, we need big, obvious warning labels instead of enticing catchwords. I mean, the people still don't understand largely what high fructose corn syrup is and partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. And, you know, you see the term enriched wheat flour. You think that's a good thing. people don't know how to read labels.
Because marketers are allowed to do this.
I've said this for years, but I anxiously await the time when the public understands that highly processed foods like tobacco can be addicting and contribute to diseases leading to an astonishing number of deaths and human suffering. Look what's happened to cigarettes. I mean, it's taken years and years and years and years. It's taken 50 years.
But it's policy that's really cut back on the smoking numbers. It's government public policies that has really helped in the fight against tobacco.
That's true. And the expense and the taxing.
Yes, exactly.
You know,
which is
$10 a pack.
Right.
Well, I look forward to the day when unhealthy foods bear the Surgeon General warning. Just as
totally agree.
As tobacco does.
Totally
but,
agree.
You know, it's a huge problem, and I don't know what the answer is.
I was in Colorado Springs a couple of years ago in a shopping center there. And I was totally disgusted. And, of course, everyone told me I was reading far too much into it. You know, these play areas they have in shopping centers, you know, kids jump all over different things. Well, all the things they were playing on were like strips of bacon, hash browns, junk food, French fries, like all of these, what are these things I'm thinking? If you know what I'm talking about, these playgrounds in shopping centers.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
All of them were in the shapes of different junk foods that happen to be available in the mall. Come on. I mean, of course, everyone said, okay, Sherry, you're just reading far too much into it. I don't think so.
No, I don't think you are either.
That's called subliminal seduction.
That's a bad message to kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, I wanted your thoughts quickly on a Harvard study that just came out that said that a number of women, it was a huge number, like 80-90% of women who are what they classify as physiologically addicted to certain foods were abused as adolescents.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on that area, but all I can say is I'm not surprised that the more emotional baggage one carries from their past, the greater the tendency there is going to be for eating under emotional circumstances.
Now, everything that we've talked about with the physiological and the psychological rewards where people are getting it from, behavior modification, behavioral support we need to provide for people. Where do you think, I'm a big believer in the concept of neuroplasticity. And that our behavioral change that we have to help people with is, as I say, neuron by neuron, getting people to change habits, behaviors. But number one is what your book covers is understanding and doing a good analysis of why I eat.
I agree. And I too am a big believer in adaptation and neuroplasticity. So look, we're addicted to food, we're addicted to water, we're addicted to air, because without them we will die. And that's as opposed to tobacco, alcohol, drugs, and gambling, which are unique addictions, they're not necessities. So eating clearly is a highly rewarding and pleasurable activity, and because of that, as I stated before, it has the potential to be abused. So ultimately, through mindfulness, I believe that we need to make the effort to achieve the proper balance between pleasure-seeking on the one hand and the need for restraint on the other hand.
Exactly.
We need to be aware. We need to be cognizant. We need to try to avoid eating when not hungry, when emotional states of mind give us a false sense of hunger, because although, as you stated, we achieve short-term soothing, in reality, it represents a need that should be addressed by more appropriate behavior.
Yes.
Now, the limbic system, including the amygdala and other pleasure pathways, are present, and through neuroplasticity and adaptation, those are the basic processes that our brain's neurons can undergo actual anatomical changes and network reorganization, new neural connections that can be generated in response to new situations or environmental changes. So, in other words, we can actually modify the electrical hardwiring of our brain through learned pleasurable behaviors. And it's a dynamic thing, constantly subject to change. We can develop new behavioral patterns that are not maladaptive, that are adaptive.
Thank you. That's what I was waiting to hear you say.
They can become firmly established. You know, our neural pathways can be modified in such a way, I believe the term is synaptic sculpting. I love it.
They I love it too.
Sculpted so as to facilitate repeated behavior in the future. So thus is explained on a biological basis how a behavior becomes ingrained. And the good news that comes out of this is that just as behaviors can be learned, maladaptive behaviors, they can also be unlearned through the process of synaptic pruning because of the plasticity of the system. So we can ultimately synaptically prune the bad behaviors and sculpt the good ones.
Fantastic. Love it. Standing ovation there, Doc. Okay, so now, what advice would you give parents who are raising small children to help them develop, from a very young age, a healthy relationship with food?
Three words, and I think you said it and answered this earlier, lead by example.
Yeah.
I love the term secondhand eating, which parallels secondhand smoking.
Yes.
Basically, kids follow their parents, take them shopping to the supermarket, have them watch the preparation of the food. Listen, my wife and I eat well. My kids are going to eat well. Can you blame children for being obese when their parents are obese and keep a house stocked with junk food and eat fast food three times a week?
I was at a shopping mall a couple of months ago, and I saw something. I got to tell you, Doc, I dropped. I saw a couple eating at the table. They're eating typical mall junk food, and they're both morbidly obese, and they're there with their child, who they've put in front of their child a bunch of carrots and celery. And the kid is screaming. The kid didn't want, shocker of all shocker, didn't want the vegetables, wanted the fries. It's heartbreaking.
That's terrible.
I know, again, this is something people can sometimes come down hard on me. I don't think you can tell your children not to smoke if you smoke yourself. I think you're sending conflicting messages.
Absolutely.
Your kids have to see, or our kids have to see, that we are physically active. And no matter, look, you're a logical surgeon. You're a busy guy, okay? But clearly, you model it for your family that being physically active is important.
Absolutely. And just getting beyond that, too, just not, as a physician, I feel like I need to be a role model for patients. I can't tell somebody they need to lose weight if I'm not in good shape.
Yeah.
I will have no credibility whatsoever.
No, I totally agree with you there. Being a health coach is that I want to look healthy. I want people to look at me and say, yeah, you walk the walk, you talk the talk. There's no question. There's absolutely no question. Okay, so I'm the type of person that, it's exercise to the rescue, okay? I know factually, not just, with clients, I know with myself when I have those certain time of the month cravings, hunger, when I know logically I shouldn't be, especially late at night when I'm tired. I know that a good dose of physical activity, again, doesn't have to be in the gym. I'll sit on my bed sometimes and do some core workout. Okay, there's many ways we can reward that screaming out dopamine reward circuitry. Okay, it reminds me, it remotivates me. I get clients to do that. How do you feel about exercise to the rescue?
Oh, my God, I am just like you. I mean, I describe myself truly, as an exercise addict.
And you know what? I'm really proud of you the way you say that, because there's people who criticize it. Now, I go on and live my life, and so do you. You're a successful man with a family, so clearly you live your life as well. But people, I guess, it's part of that centripetal guilt, I call it, okay? It's an addiction.
Listen, it's a great addiction. It's an adaptive addiction. We have physical presences. Our bodies are meant to be worked. I truly feel like our dogs that need to be let out in the backyard and run.
Yep.
We need to be run. It's hardwired into us. I need to exercise. It makes me feel good. It releases a surge of dopamine and other happy chemicals. It is an incredible way for me to tap into my internal pharmacy. It empowers me. It makes psychologically, emotionally, it makes me feel great. When I'm fatigued, it wakes me up. If I don't get a dose of my exercise for a few days, if I'm ill, I feel it. I go into withdrawal and I feel lethargic. I think exercise is a wonderful alternative to satisfying cravings and hunger. It's a great adaptive activity. I think it's a wonderful secret that many people don't even realize, its power.
That's right. That's right. There's no question. Dr. Siegel, you have been an amazing amount of help. Do you have any websites you'd like to refer us to?
Let's see. For more information on the book,
please,
it's www.promiscuouseating.com. I do a blog once a week on exercise, wellness, fitness, sometimes urology subjects, and that's at www.bergenurological.com. That should do it.
Wonderful. Dr. Siegel, it was an absolute privilege to have you on the show, and what can I say? Thank you so much.
It is absolutely my pleasure. Totally enjoyable.